Just another day in the United States of America. Another day of gunfire, panic, and fear.
Yep, just another day.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica
with you.
Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast.
So
as heard on 90.7 FM in LA. In Oregon, 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 FM KSO in Cottage Grove, 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. Of course, coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org. On the Progressive Voices channel, on Netroots Radio, on Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio, RadioOrNot.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, and of course, Radio Sputnik 5 days a week, and that's just a partial list. Glad you could join us. Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow here from bradblog.com. And it is, once again, another thrilling action-packed adventure for you that we call the Bradcast. Of course, it's difficult balancing our need here on this program, our need to report on, the shiny objects of the day, balancing that with covering the stuff that actually matters over the long term. That's always difficult. That's always a tough call. Of course, with the breaking news in our backyard on Wednesday, that horrific shooting in San Bernardino, that was an easy call, even if it meant pushing everything else back for another day or two or more, as we had to do as that story broke yesterday just before we went to air. But come hell or high water, come holiday, come breaking news, come cold and flu, we will cover the climate conference going on right now in Paris, as it is currently the only path now for saving the entire planet, which I think is kind of important. What do you think, Desi Doyen?
It depends on your perspective. If you plan on being alive in, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, yeah, you might want to pay attention.
No, wait a minute. Are you saying in 5, 10, 20, 15, 20 years, we're not going to be able to survive climate change that soon, that early? I think you're getting out ahead of your skis there, young lady.
I would say that for certain people in certain locations, yes, they will not survive.
For certain people in certain locations, you're absolutely right. That, of course, is Desi Doyen, our producer, my co-host on the Green News Report. We will have one of those coming up shortly. And as I say, finally, we will get to some coverage of Paris, and I hope to of the UN Climate Conference in Paris, and hope to get to much more as the conference continues this week and next week. It may not be as exciting as a breaking shooting or whatever obnoxious thing Donald Trump and other Republicans like him, which, by the way, make no mistake at this point, they are all like him. They are all like him at this point. So it may not be as interesting as you know, what stupid thing those people had to say. But we will be covering it. So we will have both some follow-up on those horrific shootings yesterday in San Bernardino. And we will focus on a few other items today that desperately need coverage. Among them, two new accountability stories of a sort. Perhaps lack of accountability stories concerning both the coal industry and the oil industry. And now it looks like Nobody will face real accountability for the deadly 2010 BP oil spill disaster in the Gulf of Mexico that killed 11 men. Though we may have a bit of accountability on the coal side of the issue today concerning the 2010 Massey Energy mine disaster at the Upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia that killed 29 miners. just days before the BP explosion and that oil spill that wrapped the attention of the world for months during the summer of 2010, which no doubt came as a pleasant surprise to Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey Energy, where those 29 workers were killed in that horrible explosion. Don Blankenship, of course, long known as the Dark Lord of Coal in West Virginia, and he was a big Republican power player. He was the CEO of Massey Energy during that Upper Big Branch mine disaster. Well, on Thursday, Don Blankenship was convicted of a federal charge of conspiring to violate mine safety standards. That was part of a case that emerged after the accident, described by the New York Times as the deadliest in mining in the U.S., the deadliest in mining history in the U.S., at least for decades. The verdict reached by a federal jury finding him guilty made Mr. Blankenship the most prominent American coal executive ever to be convicted of a charge connected to the death of miners. He had been accused of conspiring to violate mine safety regulations as well as of deceiving investors and regulators. Prosecutors secured a conviction on only one of three charges. Mr. Blankenship was acquitted of making false statements and securities fraud. He faces a maximum of just 1 year in prison on the misdemeanor conspiracy charge.
A misdemeanor.
Misdemeanor. And he's only facing a maximum of 1 year. We'll see what, if anything, he gets. This is seen as a defeat for the Justice Department by many. They had pursued a prosecution that could have led to a 30-year prison term for Blankenship. Lawyer for Blankenship said he, of course, intends to appeal. You'll be shocked. This William W. Taylor III, the leader of Blankenship's defense team, said he's confident they will prevail on appeal. Judy Berger had allowed Blankenship to remain free on bond until his sentencing expected next spring. Yeah, what did I say?
You said just Judy Berger.
Oh,
you mean
not
Judge Judy.
Actually,
Berger.
No, I don't even know if she's Judy. I meant Judge. You're right.
Okay.
Judge Berger allowed him to go free. The prosecutor has asked that Mr. Blankenship be jailed or confined to his home until sentencing, but it looks like that's not going to happen. Prosecutors had constructed a case accusing Blankenship of putting his pursuit of profit for himself and his company ahead of the safety of the miners who worked for him. Jurors throughout the course of the trial learned about his demands for production reports from the Upper Big Branch every 30 minutes. Did you know about this?
He was asking, I knew that he had gone far overboard and beyond, I think, what most people would consider even reasonable in trying to force his workers and his mine managers to increase production without increasing their personnel, without increasing their safety equipment, without increasing pretty much any of the equipment that they would need in order to increase production safely. And, you know, they kept arguing all along in the trial that, you know, he wasn't doing this. He's a big friend of the miner. And look at all these wonderful things that he's done, this new program he's instituted that makes mining so much safer, even though, of course, you look at it objectively and it does not. They also tried to argue that the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, did not was at fault for the Upper Big Branch mine explosion that killed those 29 men.
Wait, that MSHA was the government organization was at fault, not Don Blankenship? How was the government at fault for that?
Because they would say that what they argued was that what MSHA, the mine safety regulator, what MSHA was requiring them to do, the actual procedures that they were requiring the mine to go through and the equipment that they were requiring them to undergo, to buy and to install to limit coal dust, explosive, flammable coal dust, they said that particular requirement from MSHA was what caused it. And if only they had let Massey Energy use their own system, then this all would never have happened.
Amazing. As I was saying, Blankenship was asking for production reports, keeping the profits up every 30 minutes, even on weekends. And jurors heard him on audio recording, chastising, lecturing subordinates We had a few years ago, we ran, I think it was after the, I can't remember if it was after or before the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, but that video, that footage of Blankenship roughing up a reporter, remember that, on camera?
If I remember correctly, that was from before the Upper Big Branch mine explosion. And it was basically somebody saying, hey, you know, what you're doing here, you're endangering your miners. And he just basically shoved the guy and shoved the camera and all of that. So he's not a good person. And his little mustache that he has, you call him the Dark Lord of Coal.
Yeah.
I mean, if he had a top hat, yes, he would be like Snidely Whiplash.
There
I mean, he
go.
Looks just like him.
The government insisted Blankenship and Massey Energy had embarked on little more than a safety charade with with the actions that they did take. And Blankenship, meanwhile, a Republican, he exerted wide influence on West Virginia politics through large contributions. And he believed that this prosecution amounted to little more than partisan revenge. He had no evidence to underscore that. But as a matter of fact, the defense didn't even put on any witnesses.
Right. That's remarkable. They did not ask him to testify in his own behalf.
Apparently they
didn't
need to.
And they brought zero defense.
They
were that confident.
Yeah, apparently so. I should say, however, that while he was a diehard Republican, you know, in West Virginia, we had to get our friend Bob Kincaid on here to talk about this soon. But in West Virginia, even the Democrats are Republicans.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. So it wasn't just Republicans who were making life easy for Blankenship.
Big Coal has a stranglehold on West Virginia.
Well, they used to. They used to. Massey Energy has now been purchased by Alpha Natural Resources, making them, I think, one of the largest coal companies in the country. And they have now declared bankruptcy.
And also just to point out that a lot of these bankruptcy requests from these coal companies, it's really just a way to fob off their pension requirements off to the public. They declare bankruptcy. Oh, look, we can't handle, we can't pay off our pensions or our health care, the benefits that we promised retirees years ago that they worked for. Sorry.
Good point, Desi Doyen, although I will add that coal is in trouble, and it's not because of a war on coal by Barack Obama, as Republicans would have you believe. It's might be thanks to Barack Obama in that he's allowed so much fracking to go on, which has allowed
expansion.
The boom, I don't know what the word is, the expansion in fracking and natural gas, which has made coal too expensive.
Yep.
And so there you go. Free market, coal fans. Sorry. Anyway, we will see if Don Blankenship spends even a single day in jail the way these cases tend to go. That doesn't seem to happen, especially when we're dealing with what is considered one misdemeanor count at this point. And especially if we can compare it to what happened to the folks over at BP, whose rig killed 11 workers and unleashed the nation's worst offshore oil spill disaster just days after that explosion in West Virginia at Blankenship's mine. Today, the Justice Department decided to drop manslaughter charges against two BP rig supervisors, making it increasingly likely that no one will spend a day behind bars for that either. For the crimes associated with that deadly disaster. One of the rig supervisors, Donald Vidrine, pleaded guilty on Wednesday to a misdemeanor charge of violating the Clean Water Act after a judge agreed to dismiss 11 counts of involuntary manslaughter against him and Robert Kaluza. The cases against two other former BP employees already have been resolved, with one acquittal, one with a sentence of probation. Keith Jones, whose son Gordon Jones died in the rig explosion, according to AP, attended Wednesday's hearing with his other children, expressed disappointment the prosecutors dropped the most serious charges against Kaluza and Vidrine. He said, quote, as a result of this court proceeding today, no man will ever spend a moment behind bars for killing 11 men for reasons based entirely on greed. The government did secure a landmark criminal settlement and record civil penalties against the energy giant BP. That will cost the corporation billions of dollars, but in terms of individual criminal responsibility, says AP, only four mostly lower-ranking employees faced charges, and even those cases largely unraveled. Over the summer, BP agreed to a record settlement of $20 billion to states that were affected by the spill, hoping to resolve the legal drama. At the time, the company said that the settlement would bring its full obligation to an estimated $53.8 billion. They had also agreed to plead guilty to manslaughter and pay $4 billion in criminal penalties. But when BP agrees to manslaughter, nobody goes to jail because it's a corporation. Yeah, we do. We manslaughter. Oh, 11, yeah. 11 workers. Oh, sorry. What
if
do you need?
You put,
$4 billion? We earn that in a few minutes.
If you put profits over people and kill 29 miners, you would go to jail. You personally.
Don't give me any ideas, Desi.
If it was any other human being in the world doing this, taking a gun and killing people.
Yeah. Unless it was my corporation. In
right.
which case, apparently, my corporation can kill everybody they want and nobody will go to jail.
That's right.
Nice work if you can get it. Well, in any case, so Don Blankenship may be off the hook. BP executives are certainly off the hook. We'll have more on all of this, of course, with you, Desi Doyen, in our Green News Report a little bit later, covering the historic United Nations climate talks, which are now underway in Paris, as even as Republicans are working hard to undermine progress in any way that that they can. Also, we'll be speaking shortly with a Russian reporter who's covering the climate talks in Paris to get a bit of a different perspective. We cover this issue a lot from the U.S. perspective, obviously, because here we are in the U.S. and Desi Doyen is American, and so I just follow your lead on this in the Green News Report, particularly. So we'll get to hear a bit of a different perspective on this, a question I want to ask: does the former superpower, who would like to be a superpower again, who's getting there, do they consider themselves to be a developing nation at this point, Russia? So we'll talk to Dmitry Boschman about that shortly. And if so, by the way, what is it that Russia, which is oil rich and has a fossil fuel based economy now in no small part, what are they seeking out of the talks in Paris? Where Vladimir Putin earlier this week surprised observers with some pretty blunt talk about the dangers of climate change.
Yeah, it's a very big switcheroo for old Vlad.
Between those Paris talks going on and our days off over the past week while we've been out sick and the constant now daily mass shootings, we got a lot to catch up on today, tomorrow, the next day. We will continue to try to do our best over the next few days. I want to do a few updates on the San Bernardino shootings following our breaking live coverage yesterday here in Los Angeles at KPFK. That was, as we noted, the 355th mass shooting of the year in the U.S. Just after we went off the air, officials confirmed that they had caught up with and killed the two main suspects in the shootings. They were a married couple, Syed Rizwan Farouk, 28 years old, Tashfeen Malik, 27 years old. They were the primary suspects believed to be responsible for the attack that resulted in 14 people killed and 21 injured. On Thursday at the Inland Regional Center. They were a married couple, each of Pakistani descent. Farouk was a U.S. citizen born in Illinois. His wife Malik was not. She was in America on a K-1 visa, which allows the fiancé the fiancé of a U.S. citizen to temporarily enter the country. In July 2014, she got that visa after Farouk had traveled internationally to meet her, according to police. The two had a six-month-old daughter. Police chief, San Bernardino police chief, said the couple had an enormous amount of ammunition. 12 crude pipe bombs were found in their house, hundreds of tools that could have been used to construct more bombs. There was obviously a mission here. We know that, says FBI LA Assistant Director David Bowditch, but we don't know why. And we don't. We are learning more, and I saw some unconfirmed reports that I think I'm going to hold on covering today about some of the victims that could have been at the heart of this reported dispute that apparently Saeed Farouk had with one of his co-workers, after which he left the holiday party and came back with his wife in fatigues and with their assault rifles. Farouk had been working as an environmental inspector for the San Bernardino County Public Health Department. He inspected restaurants and public swimming pools, among other things, for the last 5 years, made about $70,000 a year. He was a Sunni Muslim, according to one profile. He considered his family, quote, religious but modern. His interests included reading religious books, just hanging in the backyard, doing target practice with his younger sister and friends. His estranged father was shocked at suggestions that religion may have been a motivating factor in the attack. Co-workers told the LA Times that Farouk had recently traveled to Saudi Arabia, but they had expressed similar disbelief that religious extremism drove him to kill. He never struck me as a fanatic. He never struck me as suspicious, said Griselda Reisinger, a former co-worker, told the New York Times. Farouk had been involved in this workplace dispute, about which details have still not come forward. We're still learning about those. We'll, I suspect, learn more in the next few days. His brother-in-law, Farhan Khan, told reporters, he said, quote, I have no idea why he would do something like this. I have absolutely no idea. I am in shock myself. So obviously the right wingers are all over this as, oh, look, it's another Muslim extremist, more jihad. It's ISIS who's behind all of this. Religious extremism. Well, they don't say religious extremism. They say Islamic extremism, because otherwise then we'd have to point out that just days earlier in Colorado Springs, the shooter at the Planned Parenthood, which left 3 dead and 9 injured just days earlier, that shooter thought that he too was doing God's work. But of course, he wasn't Muslim. He was a Christian terrorist in this case. The former wife of Robert Louis Deere Jr., former wife from 1985 to 1993 in that Planned Parenthood shooting on Friday, said that he had attacked Planned Parenthood before. He had put glue in the locks of Planned Parenthood clinic some years ago, about 20 years ago. She said for him to plan this and go there, he meant to go there. There is no doubt in my mind. And a source told the New York Times that Deer was very religious and that he praised anti-abortion extremists, saying that those who attacked providers were doing God's work. That was the shooter at the Planned Parenthood clinic. God is very busy apparently this week, although he is so far not answering the thoughts and prayers of the Republicans who are calling on God to fix all of these problems, all of these mass shootings. We covered many of the tweets yesterday from the Republican presidential candidates, virtually all of whom described their thoughts and prayers for those in San Bernardino and for the first responders and for the victims. Rather than calling on anybody to actually do anything about this, they called on God to somehow fix this with prayers and thoughts. As it turns out, according to the front page, the front cover of the New York Daily News, in huge letters, huge block letters, God isn't fixing this. New York Daily News included a number of those tweets from Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Paul Ryan, Lindsey Graham, and the rest. And right there on the front cover, God isn't fixing this, in huge letters, 14 dead in California mass shooting, as latest batch of innocent Americans are left lying in pools of blood. Cowards who could truly end gun scourge continue to hide behind meaningless platitudes. Contrast that with the Rupert Murdoch-owned New York Post and their cover today. Rupert Murdoch, of course, owner of News Corp, which is the owner of Fox News. Their cover on the New York Post, Muslim killers in huge block letters. Terror-eyed as couple slaughters 14 in California. I don't remember if New York Post or not had a cover Christian killer last week in Planned Parenthood. That tabloid, of course, is known for their salacious covers, including a screen grab from the body camera of the shooter who killed two Virginia journalists on air in August. Remember that? Hard to keep track of all of these mass shootings that are now going on day by day, more than one per day. Harry Reid is citing Harry Reid, of course, Senate Minority Leader, Democrat Harry Reid, is citing the NRA as a quasi-militant wing of the Republican Party at this point, which is a shocking statement. I don't think they're quasi at all. I think they're a fully formed militant wing of the Republican Party, the NRA, the terrorist enablers at the NRA who have spent millions trying to ensure that absolutely nothing is done about gun violence in this country, and have spent millions buying those thoughts and prayers from those Republican politicians. They have spent millions, in fact, trying to make sure that those on the terrorist watch list are still able to buy guns without background checks or anything else. They're getting their money's worth, that NRA. Hours before the San Bernardino shooting, on Wednesday morning, a group of doctors, coincidentally, arrived at Capitol Hill to deliver petitions signed by more than 2,000 physicians around the country, pleading with lawmakers to lift a restriction that for nearly two decades has essentially blocked the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from conducting research on gun violence. They were joined by a handful of Democratic lawmakers as the doctor spoke about the need to view violence as a public health epidemic and to research ways to solve it, as the country would with any disease causing the deaths of thousands of Americans each year. We have talked about that on this show now for a long time. It is a public health epidemic, but we do nothing about it. We do nothing about it, even as Republicans pretend to worry about the safety and the security of Americans. They don't actually give a damn about the safety and security of Americans, or they would do something about gun violence, which, as scientist Neil deGrasse Tyson pointed out in a number of three tweets, this was back in November after the shooting at Umpqua College. Remember that? That ended up killing an assistant professor and eight students, injuring nine others. That was just last month up in Oregon. At the time, Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeted some remarkable statistics. He three tweets. He first said 1.4 million. That's the number of Americans who died in all wars fought since 1776. Meanwhile, 1.4 million is also the number of Americans who have died via household guns just since 1968. So the number of Americans killed in all American wars since 1776, equals the number who have died from guns, household guns since 1968. 400,000 Americans died fighting in World War II, deGrasse Tyson notes. Meanwhile, 400,000 Americans have died by household firearms just since 2001. Since 2001, we have lost as many Americans as we did in all of World War II. Lost Americans thanks to household firearms. Finally, Neil deGrasse Tyson said 3,400 is the number of Americans who died by terrorism since 2001. That would include those lost at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on 9/11. 3,400 Americans have died by terrorism since 2001. In the meantime, 3,400, the same number of Americans, have died by household firearms since 5 weeks ago. For every time a household gun is used legally in self-defense in this country, there are 4 unintentional shootings, 7 assaults or murders, and 11 attempted or completed suicides by firearm. But by all means, let's do absolutely nothing about gun violence other than offer our thoughts and our prayers. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Well, the world may be waking up from history in Paris right now as the largest gathering of world leaders in world history took place earlier this week as the UN Climate Summit Conference. What do we call COP21? I always have trouble with this. The Conference of Parties, right?
Yeah, you got it right. Okay. The 21st meeting of the Conference of Parties.
21st meaning they've been doing this every year for 21 years at this
yes.
point, and they're still trying to get an agreement on how to curb climate, curb emissions.
Well, it's only the future of the planet and the global energy system that we have all relied on for a century. Gosh, what do you want?
That's true. I was thinking last night, the World's Fair, 1904 in Missouri, my old home state. They premiered these electric lights for everyone. Everyone was oohed and awed by it. And here we are 100 years later, and we're like, oops, I guess we should have thought about that in advance. How are we going to pay for that? The energy to power the world. Well, it has been costly for sure. And the nations of the world are now trying to figure out what the hell to do about it, how they can curb emissions so the planet can move forward without the 2 degrees. 2 degrees Celsius is
without overshooting
that.
2 degrees Celsius target. That's the point at which we're going to get into really catastrophic stuff.
Yeah.
It's going to be bad at 2 degrees, but they think that it might be survivable. Let's put it like that.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what they're trying to do, trying to limit it to 2 degrees. The world leaders spoke earlier this week. Not that you would have heard about it with everything else going on. Here was a minute or two from President Barack Obama's remarks at the Paris Climate Conference.
I believe, in the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that there is such a thing as being too late. And when it comes to climate change, that hour is almost upon us. But if we act here, if we act now, if we place our own short-term interests behind the air that our young people will breathe and the food that they will eat and the water that they will drink and the hopes and dreams that sustain their lives, then we won't be too late for them. And my fellow leaders, accepting this challenge will not reward us with moments of victory that are clear or quick. Our progress will be measured differently in the suffering that is averted and a planet that's preserved. And that's what's always made this so hard. Our generation may not even live to see the full realization of what we do here, but the knowledge that the next generation will be better off for what we do here. Can we imagine a more worthy reward than that? Passing that on to our children and our grandchildren so that when they look back and they see what we did here in Paris, they can take pride in our achievement. Let that be the common purpose here in Paris, a world that is worthy of our children, a world that is marked not by conflict but by cooperation, and not by human suffering but by human progress, a world that's safer and more prosperous and more secure and more free than the one that we inherited. Let's get to work. Thank you very much.
That, of course, was President Obama speaking at the opening ceremonies for the climate conference going on in Paris, where they really need, this is the year, they really need to come up with an agreement with the rest of the world to solve climate change, or at least get on the path towards solving it the way we have solved similar climate crises in the past, whether it was acid rain, whether it was the ozone layer. We're going to talk more about the U.S. role in all of this coming up shortly in our Green News report. But to get a different perspective on those climate talks in Paris, we're joined now by Dmitry Boschman, who is covering the Paris climate talks for Sputnik News in France, where he is the chief editor for Radio Sputnik in Paris. Dmitry, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for staying up late for us out there today.
Hello, Brett. Thank you.
Now, folks that I've heard from out there in Paris, in Europe, some of whom have been working on security issues in advance of the Paris summit, have said that security, particularly in the wake of the November 13 terror attacks out there, has never been higher. Tell me, before we get into the contours of the actual climate talks and so forth, tell me about the security measures and the concerns that are in place for this meeting, Dmitry.
So that's true. As you might know, the state of emergency is currently declared in France, which means heavy restriction on freedom of gathering. But some activists decided that it was a violation of their fundamental rights, and at first they found some creative ways to protect to protest. They were leaving their shoes on the pavement near Place de la République, and still the peaceful protest didn't last for long, and it all ended up with tear gas and arrests. There were also reports that the rapid train line from Brussels, it's called Thalys, it was blocked, and it turned out that someone actually committed an act of sabotage. So it was interrupted for almost a day.
Wow, I hadn't heard about that. We did see the reports of the tear gas, of the mace that was used against demonstrators out there, which, as you say, Dmitry, have been banned during the conference due to those security concerns. Has there been any incidents since then as far as protesters or demonstrators go, or did that tear gassing pretty much do the job of dampening any further demonstrations out there?
It pretty much did the job. So it all happened during the first day. Mm-hmm. So far, it's been calm for a couple of days.
Gotcha. And this was the largest gathering of world leaders, I think, in history. Aside from the demonstrations that were disallowed, what about security at the facilities itself, where the leaders were? I think a lot of them have now left, but were the media allowed to get close to those events, to those opening speeches and so forth, where those leaders were gathered?
Not all of them. The measures that the French police took was really unprecedented. It all started from the airport, mm-hmm. which became a sort of a fortress, and it went all along to Le Bourget, mm-hmm. where the meeting took place.
Now, are you able to get a sense of the mood at this conference, other than the security issues, but the actual, let's talk about the climate issues, the mood either among the direct participants out there or among the activist groups and so forth on the periphery of the summit? Is there optimism, Dmitry, that a deal will actually be struck this time after several tries at it over past years, past UN conferences?
I should say that there are two groups of people that show optimism now in France. It's the government and the Greens. And the two of them are linked between each other because Hollande got elected with the support of the Greens.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the French government
I'm talking about the French government.
Okay.
I would say that the local media made such buzz around the event as if it were the World Cup, and there was indeed this feeling in the air that the change was possible. But meanwhile, there is a lot of skepticism now about the possibility of signing a binding agreement at the end of the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I can judge, people, French people, start losing interest. People talk about terrorism, Syria, and Erdogan, and that's what the press is more interested in.
Really?
Rather than addressing the environmental issues. And it actually doesn't look like a Super Bowl. It looks more like a weird family sitcom with François Hollande sitting next to his ex-wife, who is now the Minister of Ecology in his government, you know, participating in panel discussions. So,
well, I would guess so. So you're saying that there's more interest, more concern in security and the shoot down of the Russian plane and so forth by Turkey, then there is focus at this point in France on these climate talks, that's almost a sideline issue at this point?
That's what interests people.
Okay.
At this point. And some people who criticize the French government, they say that it's actually more important than the climate change at this point.
And we hear that in this country too, of course, from folks who say, terror and ISIS is a much greater threat than climate change. Although, while it may be more of an immediate threat with so much that is currently going on, I should think the survival of the species on this planet is ultimately a greater existential threat. But we certainly see that in this country. Dimitri, I know you cover politics for Sputnik in Paris, but I'd love to ask you about, since you work with Sputnik, about Russia and their stake in all of this. Their economy has become very much based in fossil fuels. So any agreement in Paris to reduce emissions could lead to an eventual reduction in that sector of the Russian economy. Vladimir Putin came out and made some pretty strong statements, at least in the opening of the conference, calling climate change one of the gravest challenges humanity is facing, cited hurricanes, droughts, floods, and other anomalies as the source of economic damage thanks to global warming. What is the Russian stake here? What is the Russian interest? Are they really interested in curbing emissions? What are they hoping to get out of a global climate agreement, to your understanding?
To my understanding, President Putin's speech was quite a surprise, and it was also quite symbolical. As a relatively poor country, mm-hmm. if we take the GDP per capita, mm-hmm. Russia has always been more concerned about development issues rather than environmental problems. Hence, the change in rhetoric that we can witness at COP21 is even more symbolic. So Russia takes credit for a significant progress they made in reducing carbon emissions within Kyoto Protocol. So the current plan is to reduce the emissions by 30% by 2030, as compared to 1990 when it was signed.
Mm-hmm.
But there also, President Putin spoke about the new priorities for Russia. It is the use of energy efficient technologies, as well as preserving the Russian forests that absorb carbon dioxide naturally. So for Russia, it's important that the forests be mentioned in the final document that is going to be signed after the conference.
One of the, the big sticking point, I suppose, that has been ongoing at these talks both this year and in previous years is how much the developing world, like India, for example, you know, will be compensated from the rest of the world to help them grow their economy to catch up with wealthier nations, who had the luxury of coming to power on a dirty fossil fuel based economy. Does Russia consider themselves part of that so-called developing world that would hopefully, in part of any agreement here, actually receive compensation to help them leap over the industrial revolution, the fossil fuel based industrial revolution. In any event,
Russia actually there are two approaches to that problem. Either we evaluate the green record of every country by the emissions per capita, mm-hmm. or we take the overall emissions.
And of course, U.S., we lead the world, I believe, in per capita emissions, whereas China leads the world in overall emissions.
Yes, yeah. Russia actually is more than any country interested in a compromise on this matter. So,
but would they like to receive money, receive compensation, essentially, for skipping the fossil fuels and jumping right to renewables, renewable technology, and so forth?
But of course they are. Mm-hmm. But the main idea that they want to recognition for the amount of forests that they have on the territory, and because it naturally absorbs the emissions, mm-hmm. the carbon dioxide.
And so they're looking for a compensation for not destroying those forests?
They're looking for a compensation for preserving the forests that serve as natural lungs of this planet. So there's one problem Russia is facing now.
Yeah.
It's because of the economic crisis. They have less money to invest in new technology, mm-hmm. in new green technology. So that's something that that is more difficult than it was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. You say, Dmitry, that Russian President Vladimir Putin has surprised some observers with his blunt talk at those opening ceremonies about the dangers of climate change. We've talked on this show quite a bit for many years about the problem that we have in this country for climate change denial and denialists. Now, Putin in the past has made some jokes about climate change, but he did seem to be serious in his opening remarks. Does Russia have the same kind of problems that we do in this country as far as what we call the denialist industry? So you've got, our president, Obama, taking climate change very seriously, but he's up against a U.S. Congress that wants to undermine his efforts, not just for political reasons, but because they are part of that denialist industry, that denialist community. Does Russia have its own denialist community, or is the country on board to take action for climate change, as you understand it?
I would call it pragmatism. So Russia has less people that are denying mm-hmm. the climate change, but it also has less green activists. So the approach is more pragmatic. But things are changing now. During the preparation for the Winter Olympics in Sochi, mm-hmm. the perception is changing among the decision makers, and the Putin's speech is just another proof that it is changing. Because and what he's saying that proves that those people are finally aware of the importance of the issue.
Well, we can only hope so, and I hope that you're right, that the French government, which seems to be feeling optimistic, I hope that spreads to the rest of the participants in the COP21 conference out there in Paris. Dmitry Boschman of Sputnik News, greatly appreciate your coverage. You're staying up late to touch base with us here today, and good luck over the next another week and a half or so of this conference. Correct?
Yep.
All right. Very good, Dmitry. We'll check back in. Stay safe out there, and thanks again for touching base with us tonight.
Thank you.
That's Dmitry Boschman. He is the chief editor for Radio Sputnik in Paris, covering the Paris climate talks for Sputnik News in France. More coverage ahead from an American point of view. Desi Doyen, you're American, right?
Oh, yes.
All right, coming up right after this break. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. world. Stop melting. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. One small correction. Desi Doyen, before the break, I said you were American.
Yeah.
You're actually born in Texas, right?
This is true.
Okay. So, you know, is that American?
Oh, it totally is. Sorry.
All right.
But I'm also part Cherokee, so I'm indigenous. So
oh,
y'all,
you're totally
all
in.
Y'all can go home. As
okay.
Far as
there
I'm
you
concerned.
Go. I was going to say Texas is like a whole nother country, but
it
whatever.
Is.
Yeah, it is. But the Cherokee, that gets you in for sure. All right. Well, we better get to it. Running late. What a surprise. Let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
There is this sort of unanimity of opinion that something has got to get done here.
Historic United Nations climate talks now underway in Paris.
Technology-driven advances are relentless. They're going to drive down costs, and they're basically going to make the cheapest thing to do the cleanest thing to do.
Governments and billionaires launch huge new investments in clean energy. Plus,
governments currently engaged in this round of climate talks will want to know that there is more than just an executive branch in our system of government.
Republicans working hard to undermine progress in any way they can.
All of that undermining and progress straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
While the world is in turmoil and falling apart in so many different ways, especially with ISIS, our president is worried about global warming. What a ridiculous situation.
And no one knows ridiculous situations better than you, Mr. Trump. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, it's quite remarkable with so much going on in the news. It's easy to not even notice the fact that this historic climate change conference is now actually underway in Paris, as you have been waiting for and anticipating for so many months.
Oh, yeah. It's history being made in Paris right now at the Global Climate Talks. The nations of the world are now meeting in Paris for the 21st Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or COP21 for short. The goal is to complete a comprehensive, international, binding agreement for all nations to cut the greenhouse gas emissions that cause dangerous global warming in order to keep the planet's temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial times.
Yeah, good luck with that.
I know. It's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Human activity has already raised temperatures by 1 degree Celsius. So, by the way, we are halfway there.
Just to clarify, halfway to the bad thing, not
yes.
Halfway to the good thing.
That's right. U.S. President Barack Obama opened the U.N. Climate Conference with an acknowledgement that developed countries like the U.S. bear responsibility to take action.
There is such a thing as being too late. And when it comes to climate change, that hour is almost upon us. I've come here personally as the leader of the world's largest economy and the second largest emitter to say that the United States of America not only recognizes our role in creating this problem, we embrace our responsibility to do something about it.
A successful global agreement includes transparent mechanisms for all countries to review their progress and ratchet up their targets as new technology becomes available. It includes measures to reduce deforestation and the biggest area of conflict, funding for developing nations so that they can prepare for climate change impacts and hopefully leapfrog over the pollution phase of development while still lifting their people out of poverty. And most importantly,
that it is an ambitious target that seeks a low-carbon global economy over the course of this century.
In other words, phasing out fossil fuels completely. One thing the Paris conference will not do is solve climate change. National pledges to reduce emissions so far are not enough to stay below the key threshold of 2 degrees Celsius. So this is only the beginning. The talks create the architecture, the framework for the decades-long transition to a low-carbon and eventually zero-carbon economy. This is the first time all nations have agreed to do so. President Obama concluded his participation in Paris with a hopeful message.
I'm optimistic. I think we're going to solve it. I think the issue is just going to be the pace and how much damage is done before we are able to fully apply the brakes.
And so far, several major new financing programs have already been launched. The White House announced two sweeping initiatives. The U.S. and 20 developed nations will increase investment in clean energy research and development. A separate initiative headed by Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates will mobilize $20 billion in private venture capital investment. And India announced a new global solar energy partnership with 121 developing countries. But here in the U.S., congressional Republicans still trying to undermine President Obama in Paris.
No.
This week passing two new resolutions to overturn Obama's landmark new emission standards for power plants, even though the White House will veto the legislation. They said it's to send a message to the world community that the U.S. might not abide by any agreement.
And to send a message that they don't like this planet really at all. They have no interest in keeping it livable, apparently.
Yet the Republicans are out of step with Americans. A new New York Times CBS poll this week finds 2/3 of Americans want the U.S. to sign on to the UN agreement.
For much more on the stories we covered today, including COP21, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. So we are halfway there, halfway to the point at which the world will become unlivable, uninhabitable. Well, it's going to get really bad.
It will get bad, yes.
And there's universal agreement here that even if everyone agrees to go ahead with the plans
in Paris,
we still ain't going to hit that 2 degree. We're going to roll right past that 2 degree mark.
Right, but this is the framework of building the bridge of where we're going to go. You got to build the framework first before you can build a bridge.
We better start building.
Oh, yeah.
My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, to Dmitry Boschman of Sputnik News, and as ever, my thanks to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is greatly appreciated. If you have any thoughts on today's program or any other, you can always drop us email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. You can and should follow us on the Twitters and the Facebooks. I am The Brad Blog over there. And if you missed any portion of today's program, you can always download it. You can head on over to iTunes and subscribe for free. Or you can stop by bradblog.com, listen to the show there, and get a whole bunch of value-added information at the same time. All right, that's it. We will continue saving the world next time. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.